Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we're going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
The sky is blue today, Marco, here in Los Angeles. Yeah. Hopefully down in San Diego as well.
It's nice today. It's real nice.
It's been a little gray
gray in the past few days.
Smoky
and gray, which is a play on something that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, and this being a webcast
with the gray
and a podcast, if people are looking, they can see something.
They already see the gray
in the background there. And we got Rick, which is in the control center and showing a book. So yeah, it's an unusual gathering. And as we're doing lately, we talk about books quite a bit and some documentaries. And we see how the cybersecurity community and the technology and humanity comes together in many aspects.
Well, we live through stories. We live through stories, and books are a great way to experience people's stories. And many times they're real. Today's happens to be. And there's also a movie that is real.
Very, very real. So. Very, very real. And I think it's going to be a fantastic conversation. Yeah. But as we often do with our co-host, we'll let the co-host introduce himself a little bit for the people that don't know Rick McElroy. And then, Rick, you can introduce your guest. We're just helping.
Yeah,
definitely. Rick McElroy, as always. Everybody should know who I am. If you don't, it's fine. Yeah. InfoSec Rick on Twitter. But really, I'm just hosting today, so I'm excited. I don't have to provide any content. I don't have to be smart. I just have to ask smart questions, which which is a rarity, right?
That's right. It's three against one today against Aaron.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Great, thanks. I'll hold mine.
No pressure.
I'm excited. I have to say that I have had some very cool things happen in my career. Over the course of being a public speaker and traveling around. And I've just gotten to meet some really cool, interesting people. And so I wind up at Carbon Black, right? I kind of convinced them to come in, and they're like, hey, by the way, our next event, like, we're bringing in Eric O'Neill. And I go, like, the guy they made the movie Breach about? Because I've seen that movie. I don't even know how many times I've seen that movie. So I felt like I kind of knew Eric. Right. And that's weird to meet somebody after the Hollywood version of their story. But I felt like I kind of met him. So sure enough, he gets off the stage. We were kind of talking, and I was like, man, I really like Eric too. Like, he's not just, an authority on spying and cyber spies and all of that good stuff. So once I put the fanboy kind of hat down and was like, oh, this guy was played by Ryan Phillippe in a movie. It was really cool just to hang out with him. We've gotten to do dinners. We've done CISO roundtables together. And then fast forward a few years, Erica published a new book, right? And so we were really excited internally to the org to sort of get those first previews. But also, like, if you read it, there's just so many things that have occurred over the last 20 years that a lot of us don't know. Because largely in the zeitgeist of America, we put the Cold War down. It was over. We won. Yay. And seemingly it has manifested itself in cyber greatly. And so it's my pleasure today to introduce not only the person that helped bring down and sort of ran point on bringing down the longest standing spy in FBI history, which is just amazing. And as I told Eric one time, you should never get put on a no-fly list again, because you should be in that realm of American heroes that did something with such a major impact that you're just excluded from some of the rules. So Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be on the podcast. And I'm always super happy to be with Rick. He knows a lot more about this stuff from a hands-on perspective than I do. I'm more of a theorist. And so when we tag team, it's always great. We've done a lot of panels together. And you know, I was also a speaker and I'm still a public speaker, although it's not very public right now. It's more sort of virtual until we can get back to stages. And I came up with many of my ideas for cybersecurity by taking everything I had learned in counterintelligence and counterterrorism, hunting bad guys in the FBI, and applying it to where I saw the bad guys going. And that was in the cyber realm. It's a lot easier to launch a cyber attack than to blow something up or to get a trust insider or a mole to spy from within an organization. And unfortunately, a lot of my theories have been proved true. So, you know, going from the stage to writing a book, it's really my story, but embedded within there are all the thoughts I've had all through all these years of talking to crowds and seeing what resonates best about cybersecurity. And Gray Day is just a way to relate cybersecurity through a really thrilling spy story.
And what I've found really interesting is that there are a lot of really good writers that write about espionage, and they are first and foremost the writers. And so they need to document themselves on what's going on so that they can actually refer to real fact and not look like fool, unless you're writing complete fantasy and sci-fi. In your case, Eric, you come from that. I mean, you're kind of telling true stories. You lived it. And I'm assuming maybe you embellish them a little bit. I don't know what's your relationship with the writing. Like, is it everything strictly real or romanticize it a little bit?
No, so what was written in Gray Day is a true story, and it's all completely true and accurate. One thing I did want to do, having written the book after we made the movie, was really tell the story in the way that it happened, which honestly I think is a lot more exciting than the Hollywood version. You know, it was just an interesting way it happened. I wanted to write the book first, but by the time I got clearance from the FBI, which took forever to tell my story, because my part was classified. It was classified at the highest levels. I was deep undercover. I was working with Hansen, and nobody wanted anyone to know what I did. So I had to get permission. And by the time I got permission from the FBI to tell my story, there were already 6 books about Hansen out. So the publishers, you know, under NDAs, loved my story, but they were all saying, well, would you write a chapter with our author? And I was like, no, we're not going to do that. I'll just not write this book. And then Hollywood got wind of it, thanks to my brother, who was a screenwriter at the time. And I didn't think a movie would get made. I thought it would just be a lot of free trips out to LA to see my brother. But it snowballed into something. And I think primarily because, and this is how it was explained to me by one producer, we were right after 9/11. The world needed a hero story and they just chose mine. So Breach happened. It's a great movie. It's taught in all sorts of government counterintelligence and national security classes throughout. I always hear from government people who are learning about how to catch a spy or how to avoid surveillance, and they're using clips from Breach. So that makes me very happy. But you know what? Books are better than movies. I'm an avid reader. I believe it.
And I agree.
I had to write that book someday.
Yeah, you know, Eric, I thought briefly, like one of the cool things that I really liked about the book is like the movie sort of covered to do that job. You can't tell anybody you're doing that job, including your closest partner. You guys are still married, your wife, right? And so I always felt like when I'm reading through the early chapters of the book, like that was awesome for me to see that personalized and like the toll that actually takes on individuals who do that role. And there's a lot of us who have carried a clearance, you know, a lot of the folks in InfoSec have sort of come out of that world. And I think, you know, just opening it up as a conversation in the community about like sometimes you lie with the greatest intention on the planet, but that has a personal impact.
Yeah, that's very true. And the book allowed me to tell that story from behind my eyes, what I was going through. But you know, it was interesting after it was published and so many people have read it. I've heard from many readers that their favorite character is my wife. She was fleshed out a lot more than the Juliana played by Caroline DiVerna in the movie could be. Because she got a lot more screen time in the book, because to me, the story wasn't about, was I going to catch Hansen or not? It was, am I going to catch this guy and stay married? And so that's a big part of the book. And Rick, you bring up something very important. I've done a lot of speaking to people that are in the undercover, you know, industry, whether they're working in InfoSec or they're working in police or military, and primarily about the difficulties of maintaining a life when you have this complete separate life that you cannot tell anybody about. And it's hard. And the main reason it's hard is because working undercover is incredibly stressful. There isn't anything more stressful because you literally can't fail. And then on the other side of it, you can't bring any of that home. So our typical support networks are not available to us. And so what happens is you end up being this fake person when you're undercover, and then all of that angst and anger that sometimes you build and stress that you build when you're undercover, you can't release when you're being your undercover role. So you end up releasing it at home to the people that you love, and that leads to pretty much the highest rates of divorce are with people who work undercover.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if you can give us a sense, Eric, of what, maybe an overview of the story, the synopsis might help, of what you experienced and the pressure that that brings. And I'm most interested in what does it mean if you fail? What does failure look like, and what's the impact of that?
Right. Well, a little bit of history. Robert Hansen was one of the highest agents in counterintelligence. He had worked in Russian espionage, so counter-Russian espionage, for the majority of his career. He also was a 25-year FBI veteran who spied for Russia for 22 of those years. So very early in his career, he volunteered himself to the Russians, which means that he wasn't recruited. He contacted them and said, "I'd like to be a spy for you." They vetted him, and his first act of spying was to give up two individuals who were later arrested, and one was killed. So he was a bad guy, and he gave up countless secrets, everything from secrets regarding our nuclear weapons program to contributing to the loss of every single US and UK asset in Russia. All of the spies who were working for us in the years 1984 and 85, which we call in the FBI and the intel community, we call the year of the spy, that sort of bridge between 84 and 85, when we lost every single Russian helping us out, and countless other operations that he dismantled. So he's a bad guy, and he's known as the worst spy in American history, certainly the worst spy in the FBI's history. The problem is we didn't learn about him until that 22nd year, when he, you know, way past when he was getting ready to retire and was about to make one last drop. A source was recruited by a joint FBI-CIA task force. The source was willing to give information that pointed at Hansen in return for a better life in America for himself and his family. A great retirement package. And they needed to prove that he was not just the spy that was about to make a drop in the 2000s, but was the spy who had done all that damage in the 1980s. That was the bulk of his espionage. So we had to build a case. We couldn't arrest him without building the case. We had to catch him in the act, but also make that connection between the Robert Hansen, and his code name was Ramon Garcia in the past, and the Robert Hansen in, you know, 2000, 2001, who was about to make that big drop to the Russians. And so their idea was to promote him to a job in FBI headquarters, in executive service, which is like the holy grail for agents, allow him to stay past his retirement. He was supposed to retire in April, and now we're in December, right, when they're making this plan, and put him in charge of what he always loved, computer systems. And so they took the worst spy in US history, and they put him in charge of the information assurance section, which today means cybersecurity. So think about that. They took the worst spy in US history, also our first cyber spy, really, and put him in charge of building cybersecurity for the FBI. And they looked around and said, "Who in the FBI knows anything about spy hunting and can turn on a computer?" And there was only one of us. So they threw me in there with them, sort of shook up the office, and said, "I hope one of these comes out okay, and we hope it's Eric. We're putting our money on him." I think probably half the FBI agents who were involved bet against me. So I had a 50-50 chance at best, and I was able to catch him.
Yeah, and I mean, Sean, like the timing of everything, right? And I'm not going to spoil the book. I'm not going to spoil the movie, but like, needless to say, sometimes these things are real time. Like, this is the thing that needs to be done, and you have minutes to do that, right? And so I just wanted to reiterate, like, not only was it all of these agents, all of this planning, all of this stuff, but then executed brilliantly in a very small window of time, which I always think is fascinating too. To Eric's point, right, hit that impact of, well, this is a bad guy that's going to walk. Not only is he going to walk, but I mean, he directly was responsible for loss of not only U.S. life, but like massive amounts of national security interests as well. And the interesting part of it, if you, you know, read the book, I think over the movie, I think the book covers this a little bit more, is the motivation behind it, which Hansen in particular, and, you know, I've happened to study a lot of this stuff, but like in particular, it was random that like he wasn't recruited, right? Like that you know, you call up the other side that you want to work for. That doesn't happen very often. And
So Hansen was a mastermind, and I truly believe that he needed money, and he was angry at the FBI. They didn't give him the job he wanted, and they didn't put him in the field. They didn't give him field ops. They put him they made him an analyst, which, by the way, is the bread and butter of intelligence work. There's nothing more important. I mean, as a field op, all the work I did, I could only do because analysts did all the hard work to give me the intelligence I needed to figure out how to catch the bad guy. Hansen was upset about that because, I mean, it sounds a little bit off the cuff, but he truly wanted to be James Bond. He was a James Bond fanatic. You're getting in the mind of a bad guy now, right? And he needed money, and at the same time, he was angry at the FBI, and he was a narcissist. So those are all hallmark examples of someone who becomes a mole or a trusted insider and the psychology of this. And he knew all about the Russians. He was working Russian counterintelligence. He knew all about our field offices. He knew all about the Russians. He knew who the bad guys were. He knew who our spies were. So he had a lot to sell. And he must have just thought one day, wow, I can make a lot of money doing this and I can get back at the FBI. And so he volunteered himself.
Sounds like the guy with the perfect ingredients to become the villain in the movie. Like you said, the James Bond, exactly. But it's actually, is, you know, every hero can also be the villain. You just decide which side you want to be, right?
And so, that's espionage. He was Russia's hero, right? The Soviet Union's hero. And then Russia's hero. That's how long he's spied.
Somewhere he was a hero. But what I find it fascinating too is that we look at, you know, say 84, 85, I mean, a span of 22 years that this guy had done a lot of bad stuff. And also that's the period that you start really using cyber. I mean, mm-hmm. just literally starting to develop computers at that level. And nowadays, you know, we're in full blown cyber espionage, manipulation, and a lot of fun stuff. So how's that experience applies to maybe some lesson nowadays?
Yeah, you know, the Russians' first big cyber attack, you know, there have been many, but it was in the 80s, an attack that we called Moonlight Maze. And I talk about it in my book, but they used servers overseas that were linked to colleges who were doing work with government, U.S. government entities in order to get backdoors into U.S. government databases and steal information. So even when we thought the Cold War was ending, they were continuing it. They just moved to a different theater of war. And they've continued. And if you look at, you know, I do draw this parallel in Gray Day, but if you look at how they built that cyber attack in the 80s using staging servers and launching attacks against actual databases that they wanted to compromise, it's very similar to what they did in 2016 to the DNC and the Hillary campaign and the DCCC, right? During the election attacks, they used staging servers overseas. They bought them they paid for them with Bitcoin. They were able to rent a server in Arizona. They launched their attack from there. I mean, the same thing. And what Rick will tell you and what I'll tell you is the bad guys will continue to do, you know, who we call the bad guys, right? Will continue to do those things that work for them until we're able to stop them. So here's an example of an attack that worked in the 80s and worked again in 2016. And shame on us for not figuring it out in that intervening period.
Yeah, and Rick, maybe your thoughts on this. I mean, you knew, I guess, Eric, you knew that it was Hansen, right? It was a person you were familiar with. You knew who he was. When you bring cyber in, how do we really get a grasp of identity and who's on the other end of the wire, and get attribution for the activities taking place so that we can identify the wrongdoing. And is the doing really wrong? Is it real, or is it manipulated, the information that we're actually seeing on the wire?
It's tough if you care about privacy, because in a world where we all had digital IDs that logged every single piece of activity that we did on there, I can do attribution through that model, right? But I'm giving up a whole lot of freedom to right. do that, right? I don't think there'll ever be a day, maybe in China might be the closest, but a day in the US where like we get to that. Like, it's close with SIM cards. They get pretty close with those, right? So if we get better SIM cloning, maybe we get to a point. But I think more importantly, and the value that I got out specifically of reading Gray Day, right, and Eric's book, was like, look, some of these tactics haven't changed. But sure, we're abstracting it in a different language because the tool that they used, right, wasn't in-person blackmail, right? It was... online blackmail because of online activity, right? So they're still blackmailing people to get them to do a thing, whether it's bring a USB stick in or steal some sort of data. But that's what they're doing, right? It just happens to be the tool set that they're using is different. So then I look at it and say, all right, the chain of events to get a person to do X is this. How do we monitor employees? How do we monitor systems, users' identities to make sure that those factors don't come in, right? And it's tough. It's one of the areas for internal security teams that are a big problem. It's like if someone's blackmailed and or working, you know, two jobs where they get paid on both sides and they have trusted access to, say, intellectual property code or writing code, that's a big problem for defenders today. But I think the other thing I think about too, and Eric, I'm interested in your answer to this. I have to say, I do quite a bit of education on disinformation. Like it's kind of my jam right now, especially as we're building up towards the election. I know that's one of the primary methods that Russia uses to sow discontent. I mean, you highlight election interference all the way back to the 70s and 80s, which is interesting. But I feel like as a populace, at least in the US, we have Russia fatigue. And so when I bring it up, people go, oh, great, we have another boogeyman, like awesome. And then I'm like, no, there's a reality, right? And then there's hype. But I was like, unfortunately, like the reality is pretty close to the hype. But what's your thoughts on like, how can we combat like that? That, you know, this idea that like we're getting fatigued on certain cyber actors who continually bust us up.
Right, well, cyber fatigue is a real problem because it leads to complacency. And, you know, to start with the attribution question Sean asked, my answer to that is, look, everyone's coming after us. We will have to worry less about attribution and more about stopping the threat because we know it's coming from everywhere. And we need to stay alert and avoid cyber fatigue. Right now, people are completely stressed out of their minds. They're working from home. You know, they have their kids downstairs learning from home, and they're not even on top of making sure their kids do their homework. And when you're in a pressure situation, when you're stressed, you're more vulnerable. We're also working from home, usually with your home laptop that has all sorts of things on it, and you're dialing into work, and you just created an entire new vector of attack. And the criminals are smart about this. The spies are even smarter. And they will find ways to exploit the stress and the pressure situation that we're under. And they're launching extremely successful attacks. I mean, let's look at the last week. The Department of Homeland Security and the FBI issues a joint release saying Chinese spies infiltrated the US government. And they say many sectors. They're doing it through spear phishing attacks and simple things like registering domains and buying passwords from the dark web. And then the DHS and the UK issue that cyber criminals are exploiting the COVID-19 pandemic. And they say they're targeting individual, small, medium businesses and large organizations. So they might as well say everybody. And basically they're trying to get the medical research that is being developed to combat COVID. And then Iran attacking Gilead scientists who makes remdesivir, which is the big therapeutic drug, South Korea, the World Health Organization. Google says that dozens of nation state cyber attack groups have used email to attack all sorts of US employee accounts. I mean, and it goes on and on. And the point is that this is a global pandemic and it's created a global cybersecurity crisis, but we keep thinking of it as sort of this national thing. And it's not. It's everywhere. It's not just about our election in the US. It is global, and it is using the pandemics and the fear and the stress to fuel 300% more cyber attacks than we were seeing before this all started.
Well, you know, you said something really important, especially for me, that I love technology, of course, but I'm more fascinated by the social engineering aspect of things, like, you know, sociology, psychology, and the fact that it's always human that are creating the technology and they are using it to defend, using it to attack. And you said, like, we can go back in time in the 80s, but we come back in time in the Middle Age or in, you know, during the Greek, the Trojan horse. It's not something happened yesterday, but we're still calling viruses like that, right? The ransomware and stuff. So I like how ultimately we're going back and say, you know, the core of the conversation is always the humans and not the technology. And it sounds to me, Eric, that you brought the human element into the story as well. Either the relationship with the family, the undercover and all of that. So I'd like maybe to spend a little bit of time to talk about the humanity of cybersecurity and the manipulation and the risk that there is out there that is not just tech. It's right. Psychology.
Well, if there's a central theme to my book, it's this. It's something that I say at every keynote. There are no hackers, right? And you know, and then I'm a cybersecurity speaker, and people look at me like, "What are you talking about?" And then I say, "There are only spies." Really think about it. And hacking is nothing more than the necessary evolution of espionage. We took all that stuff that used to be in paper and we put it in computer systems, and spies had to evolve. It's that simple. But the spies are doing nothing different. Right? The spies are still attacking people. They're using everything that espionage has always been as the world's second oldest profession. And they are using it in order to attack people. So the best spies don't attack a computer system. Now, they'll leverage software and they'll leverage technology because that's their way in, and they have to. It makes them better than the humans that are trying to defend if they can also fool the person. So all that technology, all the computers, all the cybersecurity and cyber attacks, all the malware, all of those different techniques are really just to get to a person who will ultimately be the one who makes a mistake. So it is all about humans. And so, you know, what I bring to the cybersecurity discussion isn't just, you know, a background and knowledge with computer systems, but it's a background and knowledge in counterintelligence, which is the science of stopping spies. And that's what we're doing. I mean, that is what every cybersecurity company is doing today. It's doing what 10 years ago I said we were all going to be doing. It's stopping spies, not hackers, not people who are trying to make viruses, not cyber criminals, but spies.
And Eric, I mean, when we talk about a spy, we're talking about an individual, and they have their own motivations. You mentioned Hansen was probably financially motivated, maybe not power. But I'm wondering, what's the big picture? What's the ultimate goal? What does winning look like in this world? Is it China surfaces as the dominant player in the world and they control everything? Or is it Russia? Or is that not even the picture? What is it? And why do individuals partake in whatever that ultimate goal is?
Well, just to go back to Hansen, he was a chimera. Right. So it wasn't just finances. He was always also angry at the FBI. It was also power. But ultimately, he had enough money and it became the thing that made him belong to something greater than himself. It was something that he was the best at in the world. He was the top spy in the entire world. No one had done his amount of damage. No one had lasted as long as him. And that was a hard thing for him to give up, even though he should have far earlier. So motivations for why people spy are very varied. And we always want to know the why, right? We always want to know why did they do it or who, right? Can we figure out attribution? It's important. Geopolitically, it's kind of important to know it was China or it was Russia because, you know, there's reciprocity and we want to strike back. It's one tactic. But I think that the end result of this, right, the end goal, it's not for China to become, you know, they're not spying because they think it's going to make them the most dominant country on earth. Maybe that's a hope, but it's mostly to just keep an edge, an economic edge, a geopolitical edge. And that's why every country spies. It gives you an edge on defense. It lets you know how a rival will move, what a rival will do. I mean, the number one way that foreign countries spy in the United States, in the UK, for example, is economic. The financial sector is the number one target hit year after year. Why? Because they want to know what our stock market is going to do. They want to know what we're going to do because they're playing the market too. It helps their economy. They want to know what businesses are best to target because that helps their economy. Everything is about economies. Economies drive the world, and espionage helps drive the way to cheat a little bit. And, you know, of course, everyone does it. Where we get into trouble, right? Everybody knows that spies are going to do that. Everybody knows spies are going to spy against governments. Where we get into trouble is the new concern, and I know Rick has looked at this a lot too, where we have this concern that it's not just about stealing information, it's about destroying information, it's about changing information, it's about changing public opinion, it's about attacking infrastructure, it's about preparing for real war, where kinetic attacks, you know, physical attacks with guns and missiles are linked to a denial attack using cyber attacks in order to deny communications, to deny defense systems. Like kind of what the US did with Iran, where we launched a cyber attack that shut down their capacity to fire missiles. I mean, if you're an American patriot, that's pretty freaking cool. I like the idea that we can just stop them from attacking us. That's the future of warfare. And that is what keeps me up at night.
Yeah, and then Eric, I know, so I know we've had a little talk of this. I don't know how public this is. So hopefully you'll share with us today, right? But speaking of the future, because I know we've got a couple minutes before we wrap up. I hear you're working on a new book.
I am. I'm working on my second book, which I've finished, is a fiction book. So yes, I'm stepping away from the nonfiction to what I always wanted to write my whole life. And it's fiction, but it's another spy story. You write with what you write about what you know. It's a whodunit mystery, and it follows a former Marine, a female Marine who is suffering from PTSD and gets hired as the security director for this new corporation that has just had its top IP stolen. And she's in a rush to figure out who the spy is, but also sort out her own past and survive the struggle that she has with PTSD. I've always been fascinated with PTSD ever since I learned I was suffering it after the Hansen case. So I wanted to delve into that world, and this was the character that was able to shepherd me through it.
Well, you know, we met with all the veterans and we have a Discord now, and I can tell you it would be extremely interesting to actually see somebody take on a lead character with PTSD and do it right. So I can tell you you'd have a bunch of fans. And a bunch of us would absolutely read that because we have found ourselves in that situation. So yeah. I appreciate you looking into that, Eric, for sure.
Well, I got to publish it first. That's the next step.
Well, for what it is worth, I feel like you just choose a character that, well, it's real. It's not that superhero with immense power.
Right.
It's a human being. And again, sounds to me, I haven't read the book, of course, but it seems like you're bringing a lot of humanity.
Yes, it's all about human interactions.
Once again, and I would definitely love to hear about it from you again when you're launching it, when you're ready to publish it, or when it's published. So this has been a great conversation. I know that we have limited time. So Sean, any last thoughts here before we?
I always have a question. Another question. Well, I think I'd like
enjoy.
If you don't mind, Eric, to touch on the PTSD piece and how perhaps you deal with that, either yourself or how you connect with the audience as you're speaking to them to help maybe help them identify that they are struggling and give them some tips. And I don't know if you work with organizations as well to help security teams perhaps deal with some of the stresses that they face.
So I haven't worked directly with organizations about it, and I haven't tried to speak about PTSD as an authority because I'm, you know, still just like many people trying to go through it, you know, go through the resolutions myself. For me, the cathartic experience that helped me a lot was writing Gray Day. It was putting all of that onto the pages and shamelessly so. without pulling any punches. And even when it embarrassed me, you know, I put it down there. Every time I screamed at my wife and it made me feel terrible, I got it out and I put it on the page. And, I was doing an interview with someone and he looked at me and he said, you know, I read your book and I read it as a big apology to your wife. And I said, yeah, you know, it's a lot of things and it's definitely that.
Yeah. A lot of meanings. And Rick, we kind of started with this on how you got involved with ITSP Magazine and to talk about mental health in the industry. So I think we just do a full loop and we came back to this as we wrap. So maybe a couple of words from you about this.
And, yeah, people are really struggling right now. The number of calls I'm getting from legit PT, like people are freaking out. A little bit, right? And I know for myself, I'm greatly managing that on a day-to-day basis. But look, Mental Health Hackers is great. Check out Veteran Security. There's a lot of us that are talking about it. And so mostly, I think, having the conversation, talking to other people who are in similar boats. And then, of course, if you have acute symptoms, please reach out and get some help from professionals. There's a lot more focus on it now because people have realized PTSD isn't just for veterans. There's a whole lot of people who have a lot of trauma from their past, and the symptoms, generally speaking, manifest the same. So talk about it, share it with your friends, and then seek some professional help when you have those really acute symptoms. But I think continuing the conversation and helping others has been sort of my path that has helped me.
Yeah. And extremely important.
Yeah, and I have to say, Rick, I mean, you and I connect occasionally. Behind the scenes, if you will, over the week on the weekends and things. Just to say hello, right? And I think that's an important part of this. And maybe writing, maybe reading, connecting with others, all good things too.
Yeah, the only way out is through it. I think Eric nailed it. Like putting all that stuff down on paper and working through it. It doesn't end, but I think it helps mitigate some of the symptoms for sure. Yeah,
and it's worse. I mean, it's the disease is worse when you bottle it up, when you don't talk about it, when you think that I can just be, you know, particularly men, you know, I can be a man and just, you know, ignore this, right? I don't need to see somebody about it. I don't need to talk about it. Well, we all do. I mean, we do need to talk about those things that affect us the worst. I was guilty of that, right? But, you know, my self-therapy and writing my book and a realization that I went right from the traumatic experiences that I suffered under Hansen and the FBI directly to making a movie about it and then talking about it. I never stopped. I never stepped away from it. I always was continually reliving it again and again and again. So it took me to, one, recognize that it was there, and then two, start doing a lot of self-analysis, and then ultimately writing Gray Day, which you can see it on paper. It's almost like it left and it went to there, you know? So it helped.
And well, you guys, great conversation.
And I have one more question.
You do, you can't.
Only because the word gray, I feel the gray is the color of kind of this last point that we're talking about. How did you come up with the name Gray Day?
It's a great story. It was the one name that's most important to the case that no one knew because it was classified until I submitted my manuscript for pre-publication review. It was Robert Hansen's code name. So when you're looking for a spy, and we'd hunted for a spy for all those years, for decades, named Gray Suit. And that was the name of the spy. We didn't know who it was. We didn't know if it was a man or a woman. We didn't know if that person was in the CIA or the NSA or the FBI or anywhere. But that was the name that the FBI gave the spy we're hunting for, Gray Suit. So anytime you find someone that might be Gray Suit, you give them a derivative of that name. So there was another individual in the CIA who was Gray Deceiver. And when we were put on Hansen's trail, he was Gray Day. And so I was after Gray Day, or otherwise GD. And we would never refer to him as Hansen, just in case someone was able to intercept anything we were saying or writing. So that's his code name.
Love it.
Yeah, the FBI was cool enough to declassify it for me so I can make it the cover of my book.
That's awesome. And with that, I could talk for hours with you, but we're gonna let you run. We know you have stuff to do. We appreciate your time, Rick. Thank you so much for bringing a fabulous guest onto.
No, this was awesome. Always happy.
Yeah, and Sean and Marco, thank you so much for having me on. It's been great. You guys are really easy to talk to. Well, even virtually. Thank you.
We always thank the guests for that. we just happen to be here. You guys are amazing. Thank you.
It's easy to tell good stories when there are actually good stories.
Right.
So thank you very much. And Rick, we'll see you again soon. And
cheers, everyone. Rick,
anytime, yeah. Whenever you get ready to launch the next book, just come back on. Yeah.
Perfect.
Thank you, everybody.
All right. Bye, yeah. Guys.
See you now.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and the story made you think, then share ITSP Magazine with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our columns. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.